Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Oh, welcome to the Daughter of God cast. Here we are, cozy, together again at last. We could be halfway through the story of the making of the Daughter of God, or maybe just one third of the way. We're a ways, that's for sure. Episode 016, and there's still so much to tell, you lucky people. Of course, I am the luckiest of all, because all I have to do is ramble on, while you might have to be doing dishes or changing diapers. Unless, of course, you're watching me as well, in which case, hi, hi. Let's see if we can blow through the rest of 2006. Episode 016, Deeper. 2006 was an eventful year. I'd been living in Brooklyn for about 2 years and had a pretty sweet groove going. A great place to live, creative friends, and I'd started making my first featurette, Daughter of God, although I initially thought I was making a short. Of the many friends that have croaked while I've been making Daughter of God, the first one died in 2006. I kept a trickle of cash and buku inspiration flowing, documenting live performance. I co-hosted dance parties and music jams at the United Gardens, repeatedly struck out romantically, and went way beyond the Daughter of God rough cut as I gradually found answers to why I wanted to make movies. The rough cut. A rough cut is an assembly of shots roughly corresponding to the screenplay, with perhaps some placeholder media, like music. The June 2006 rough cut starts with simple music I whipped up, and then opening shots of Jerry, Christina, and the big boat. Christina boards the boat, walks down the passage, and climbs the stairs to her cabin. Uncle Joe shows up. He and Christina talk, and then he's gone. Christina changes, sped up footage with some crossfades and more placeholder music. Now she's in the hall, entering Jerry's cabin. They talk, scene ends, roll credits. Entering this version into festivals was a sort of mad celebration, having completed a working edit just 1 month after shooting, which was pretty quick. Another milestone passed. With a rough cut already complete, what could possibly stop me? Dun, dun, dun. There was a problem. The rough cut ran 20 minutes, twice as long as I'd anticipated. Longish movies have a tougher time getting into festivals because they have to be better than at least two or three shorter movies. So basically, there was no hope. Well, there was a little hope. After mailing off the DVDs, I forgot about festivals and just kept going. By the time the last rejection showed up, I was working on a very different movie. Dancers. I provided documentation services to dancers and performers. Marian Ramirez had hooked me up in her community, but now she was long gone, traveling the world with her new love Jong-un Kim and learning Korean. My network expanded as I documented more shows. Dana Hash, Philippa Kay, Laura Peterson, Kara Tattelbaum, Elise Knutson, Jody Sperling, Zoe Klein, Mayor Hieronymus, Deborah Wanner, Antonio Ramos, Gerald Castle, Bill Young, Alexandra Beller, Amy Larimer, Rebecca Sten, Emily Faulkner, Kelly Hayes, Patricia Weiss, Christine Suarez. a who's who of the early 21st century New York City indie dance scene. Kind of a tiny pond in hindsight, but back then I felt plugged into a fascinating scene that complemented and reinforced my own aspirations. Not only did I get the chance to quietly fall in love over and over with these gorgeous people and their power, I also was scheming on how I might one day dance professionally myself. Another desire buried deep in the Dan Kelly treasure vault. Let's not move too quickly past the falling in love part. I had crushes on several of my clients, but I kept running head-on into my own self-loathing, even as I was pulling off the impossible with Daughter of God and stretching way beyond my prior incarnations. I just didn't feel worthy, and so couldn't get with the women I most wanted to sparkle with. An ongoing, tragic-comic theme of my New York experience. As a performance documenter, I gave the dance community my presence at prices they could afford, with technical support and heaps of patience as needed. Although I could have made way more money doing other kinds of production in New York City, I loved being around dance, and so I was well compensated, a wealthy man. Money was always tight for my clients, and helping audiences to find them wasn't often their priority. Making the work and performing were. Which makes sense, artists want to art. Yet the audiences were tiny in relation to the miracles unfolding on stage. That left an impression on me. How can the wider world discover us unless our work persists, flows out across the net to find our allies? I constantly advocated for more and better documentation, and when confronted with genius, I was super generous with my gear and time because I wanted to help that suffuse the world. I was mildly frustrated documenting dance. I felt many of my clients could have gone so much farther sharing their presence with the world. Yet, this was a total projection. I wanted to fly higher and farther. If ever I caught a whiff of desperation, a miasma of lack, a sense of struggle for no good reason while working with these talented and adventurous people, that was certainly my own hunger to be, do, and have way more. The frustration was not knowing I could, any time. Daughter of God quelled the frustration. Now I was channeling my energy into audacious action on my own behalf. Practice what you preach, Mr. Artist. Which of course brings us right into this moment and the Daughter of God cast. This episode may not be my best work, my opus. I am striking a balance between doing my best work and giving my allies a chance to find me. I'm not building an audience anymore. Neither am I scribbling in a closet, keeping my failures and victories private. I heard Carrie Fisher talking on NPR's Fresh Air about how she overshares, and I'm guessing that's a practice for her, of being courageous. I am being as me as I can be and letting you see. More rhymes. I do think about you coming along, about us blossoming together, brother and sister flowers, Triffids. With the ubiquity of smartphones, the latest generation of New York City dancers is likely way more savvy about outreach and persistence. I hope so. Dance is a powerful practice for waking up. Dance is a force that gives us meaning, to contraphrase Chris Hedges. There's that repurposing meme again. The United Gardens. My railroad apartment was not unlike Jimmy Stewart's in Hitchcock's Rear Window, sans my own Grace Kelly. I was on the top floor of a three-story house, with Trevor in the house adjacent and Fabrice in my house a floor below. The three of us co-rented the apartment below Trevor. Our rear windows looked out over two long, narrow backyards, the United Gardens. Between the three of us and Phil, our awesome landlord, we threw all sorts of parties, dances, and music jams. This was the golden age of the United Gardens. Ah, romance. So, along with the dog editorial, parties, music jams, dance documentation, and Tai Chi, I also found time to shave off my eyebrows, bleach my hair blonde, meet Garrett Brown, inventor of the Steadicam, learn to lockpick, record a theme song for Daughter of God, reconnect very briefly with my ex-wife and the girlfriend who saved my life after my ex-wife, host all manner of visitors, shoot post-apocalyptic exposition footage in upstate New York, drive to Michigan, and almost fall in love a few times. Lusting after dancers notwithstanding, certainly a rough year for romance. After coming back from Canada, I briefly dated someone, but she started acting erratic and then told me she was pregnant, which didn't make sense. The home test came up negative, and she confessed to making the whole thing up to get more attention. Although we weren't lovers after that, I did get a lot of alternately accusatory and apologetic emails. And then another employee at the restaurant where she worked reported her to the INS for overstaying her visa. She was picked up, interned in New Jersey for 2 months, and deported. We still keep in touch via the internets, which I'm glad for, because we're all in this together. But the whole mysterious pregnancy and deportation sequence was disconcerting, coming so soon after shooting my story about divine pregnancies and the loss of my leading man via beta border guards. I also heard briefly from my ex-wife. We'd divorced in 2000. Having only talked a few times since, I was pleased to get a mildly chatty email from her, which I replied to with lots of swell pictures. And then, nothing. In mid-August, my Toe Sox collaborator, Lauren DeCipio, dropped in for like 30 minutes out of the blue. She looked tan and fit. She was on her way elsewhere after visiting her parents in Connecticut. That's like stopping by Ann Arbor from Detroit for you Michiganders. I don't really remember who else I longed for that year, but I spent a few hours one evening taking care of a barfing girl in my bathroom. And that might have been the romantic pinnacle of 2006. Friendship. I still keep in touch with a few of my New York City friends, but many tight bonds faded or fiercely imploded before I left for good in 2010. New York City is a much more volatile environment for friendships than Beulah, Michigan. Or perhaps I was a much more volatile friend back then. The recent presidential elections definitely trimmed my extended family still further. You New Yorkers really freaked out at the results. If you've been following the podcast, you know I'm not a fan of Trumpy, but come on, saddle up. You'd rather have the wild roller coaster be totally flat? Mixing metaphors again, sorry. There was much wringing of hands and gnashing of teeth by my peeps in the five boroughs after Manhattan's iconic clown beat the pantsuited gal. I had New York City people tell me it was my fault because I lived in Michigan.
Okay, so the only things we have to fear are spiders, snakes, werewolves, sharks, dying alone, zombies, clowns, heights, big dogs, robots with human brains, Johnson's wife, and fear itself.
How often do I have to post this robot chicken snippet? Fear itself. That's what's being sold and sold hard in the USA. Don't buy it, folks. 17 intelligence agencies are going to have a tough time showing the evidence. The Ruskies didn't just liberate snarky Dem emails. Here's the signals from a nearby now take on the Russian hacking. Count via electronics? Moronic. If running private code, any script kiddie could hack. More vulnerable than Windows. Who are the black hats? Ruskies or Uskies? In the universe next door, the Ruskies were able to hack American vote counting machines because those machines are utterly insecure on purpose. And if that was public knowledge, then the American people might realize that this is not the first time they've had a government selected for them. The only difference this time around was that a foreign power did the selecting. A sly move by the Russians. America gets the clown president, hand-picked because he was the only opponent who could make Hillary Clinton look good in comparison. Trumpy will most certainly fuck up American projection of power big time, and the only way he can be stopped, short of a civil war, is by revealing that voting has been a sham for years, which the man don't dare to. A perfect crime. And that's why all the hubbub about the musty old Electoral College. If they can head them off there, then compromised voting machines can remain a state secret. You know, securing proprietary code is nearly impossible. Do you imagine a vote counting machine is less vulnerable than a Windows computer? And Microsoft is huge. In the utopian universe, voting is open source. Coming soon to signals from a nearby now near you. Odd that my alternative reality post-apocalyptic science fiction podcast is starting to sound more and more like mainstream media. That can't be good. Charlie Hansen. Meanwhile, back in 2006, on June 27th, my artist friend Charlie Hansen reemerged into the non-physical, using cancer as his excuse for bolting before my movie was done. He's responsible for the movie taking so long. He died and left me without any sense of urgency regarding completion. I wished I'd sent him a copy of the rough cut, at least. That would have been stellar. But corny as it sounds, I know he's been pulling for the project ever since and has engineered not a few coups for Daughter of God from his advantageous perspective beyond duality. He and the rest of those fun-loving dead people rushing off to fullness so they could render all manner of spooky assistance. We'll recognize all their earthly incarnations in a future episode. Why movie? There are now two reasons for this podcast, actually three. The first one is always to have fun. Fun, 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 fun. Have fun. Fun! The other two, to revel in my evolving desire to make movies and to rough out a making of documentary that could release with Daughter of God, sort of the father to Daughter of God. Basically, a blueprint for utopian Earth stewardship in movie manifesto drag. If you read the transcriptions, you might see notes in square brackets that won't necessarily be included in the audio portion of the podcast. Those are to remind me what might be cool visual components later on. We might be halfway through the Daughter of God cast. Let's say there's about 10 hours of total content, and if only 20% of that is compelling, that's 2 hours, easily a feature documentary. Maybe the working title could be Why Movie, or Why.Movie, The Legend of Shri Fuji Split. I'll probably grab that domain, Why.Movie. That's a good one. All right, enough future. Golly, we still got to get through 2006. After the rough cut was done, I tried answering the question of how do I make Daughter of God? Gradually, it became apparent that this question depended on a more existential question. Why movie at all? More questions than we may be able to answer. I didn't have a master plan or all the answers. I just knew I wanted to sketch out some more elements. Reiterate. On May 22nd, while working on the rough cut, I wrote about encounters with a starfaring civilization to explore the kinds of forces that could be influencing Daughter of God's characters. Perhaps this was a daydream or thought experiment by any of the three, Uncle Joe, Christina, or Jerry. If we send them down without wiping their memory, they get caught, tortured, and killed. You act differently when you know what we know. It's like people who almost die. Oftentimes, they don't look at the world the same way. They become alive. They stand out in a crowd. They tend not to buy into bullshit. That's like painting a target on their back. You come up to our starship. You get a good look. You aren't going to fit back into the little nook that you used to occupy down on Earth. You can't take your job or family back. Not without elaborate preparations, cover stories, fabricated evidence, etc. 1,000 points of vulnerability. Better if we just wipe your memory. Then at least you have nothing to offer the interrogators and they just leave you be. Your friends and family find you and help you assemble some kind of new life. We've got articles in all the established magazines about sudden memory loss. It's acceptable. We know and they know there's no recovery protocol. What we erase is just gone. That's all. So now make a choice. Stay up here and work with us, or go back to where you were before. The characters have transcended the mundane. They are enhanced, and yet apparently nothing special. They don't know who or what they are, what happened to them. Again with the repurposed weapons from episode 015. Here's another character study from July 15th. This applies to Jerry. We've all suffered. Everyone struggles and is defeated, is hurt, crushed, and broken. My lot is no worse than most, and a lot easier than many. Not to downplay my pain, certainly I've had a heap in helping. What's the point? The score you get after it's all said and done is based on how well we bounced back from our trials, what one has been able to accomplish after getting creamed and ravaged and ridiculed. Can you heal? What's your rate of recovery? How big a hit can you take and stand back up? That's what it's all about. Rise up and recover. Heal and learn the lesson. Reintegrate, mutate, and thrive. So that's what I'd like to exemplify. First, how to slide by destruction, and second, how to come back after the smack. How to be calm and peaceful during chaos. How to groove in dicey circumstance. Staying cool no matter how desperate the sitch. Keeping a twinkle in the eye and a sly smirk on the lips if the shit hits the fan. Certainly, avoid the convergence of flying shit and spinning fans, but if you're caught by surprise, deal with elegance and aplomb. Going conceptual with character and story informed the development of concrete deliverables, like the DVD case. Here's the elevator pitch from the interim DVD cover, which I rushed to the Terra Film Festival in July.
It's the end times. Again. Despite weaponized plague, natural catastrophe, environmental near collapse, improvised technological infrastructure, and poor hygiene, love endures. Plucky survivors shelter in the landfill of Western civilization, salvaging, tinkering, biding their time. A visit from her dead uncle sends a young refugee on a mission of salvation, seduction, or something. She's going to give birth to the daughter of God. If she can convince the awkward recluse down the hall to collaborate, it will be twice the miracle.
The summary reveals the premise and leaves a lot to the imagination. Dead uncle, daughter of God, awkward recluse, twice the miracle. Though just text, the summary provided a cognitive handle so I could better grab the simmering pot of editorial. Looking at the rough cut today, I feel a little embarrassed. Terrible placeholder music, low-quality render, choppy edits, awkward pauses in the dialogue. No wonder the festival's passed. However, the rough cut was a milestone, proving that the project worked. Creaky and ungainly, but functional. Next, sketch in more context. We've got this big boat, three quirky characters. What's that all about? Exposition of the post-apocalyptic world. Epic CG shots of abandoned cities, flipped over army tanks, and broken bridges are cliche and break my suspension of disbelief. We might marvel at the artistry, but it doesn't feel visceral. I am now totally jaded by cutting-edge VFX. I had some epic CG ideas, but I wanted something more like cracks in paint on an old bench, beautiful as seen with the light and shadows just so, but otherwise perfectly invisible, innocuous. Monsters 2010 did a decent job of this, presenting scenes of aftermath almost as throwaway detail, catching a glimpse of a ruined train at the bottom of a gorge, or the brief passing of a missile launcher trundling down a busy city street. Another film that does the minimal masterfully is American Astronaut, released in 2001, directed by and starring Corey Maccabee. Samuel Curtis's spaceship is presented as a slideshow of illustrations, and it totally works. I found this amazing movie on Netflix around 2012, thanks to Eliza Forrest. Here's my VFX principles from August 26, 2006. Approaching film like theater. You don't have to show every special effect, just suggest. Exciting when it's suggested, hinted, erotic. We don't have to parade the spaceship in front of the audience, just give them a taste, a glimpse. Was it real? I think I saw it. Most of the apocalypse I wanted was within driving distance. Anne Loding lived in Kingston, New York, with all manner of ruined industrial crap close by, even just up the street. Limestone kilns, crumbling mule barns, abandoned train cars, caves, and derelict brick factories. A few closing post-apocalyptic shots would also feature Uncle Joe, raising questions about who or what he actually was. This would be like three of the secret endings. One of three was the improvised scene with Jerry and Christina. On September 18th, my nephew Patrick and I drove up to stay with Anne, Gary, and baby A to B in Kingston and spend a few days of capturing random industrial decline. Another element of post-apocalyptic exposition was the radio broadcasts, heard at the start and during Christina's changing sequence. I did a bunch of the voices myself and also hired my friends Claire Hollerou and Arabella Clitandra for some goddess power. Suit guys. Secret ending 2 of 3 was a scene with two Uncle Joe-like suit guys kibitzing in an office. Taken together with the other secret Uncle Joe scene, this would cast Uncle Joe's visit to Christina into a new light. Not so much of a twist as a reveal. A friend of mine from Tai Chi, Philip Silverstein, was a commercial real estate broker and an actor. I asked him to find a Manhattan office location with a view. I hired Eiji-san from episode 005 and Phil to play the suit guys, and since they both spoke fluent Japanese, I had them ad-lib the first few lines in Japanese for fun. Endon, my AfriCat music mixmaster, came along to assist. We shot the scene on August 20th. F-U-D-I-P. Endon and I had been working on a mix for the soundtrack, based on Another Fucked Up Day in Paradise, a song I wrote long ago and then revamped around 2000. FUDIP, or FUDIP, is the theme song for this podcast. I sang and played acoustic instruments, and Endon kicked it with great beats and bass. This was done in early December 2006. He also created several instrumental variations for elsewhere in the movie, like in Christina's changing sequence. Christina changing. I found a speed ramping technique that transformed Christina's getting ready to talk to Jerry into a dance. And Dole's arrangement worked famously. December 19th, 2006. She is changing, yes. Let's think about the story, about our aim, and let that guide what movements. Pick sexy things, surely. Pick awkward and sublime. This is the recipe for the dance of the new epic. She is trying on different personas, attempting to find out what she is today. It's not even so much the personas as the transition between them that matters. It's the in-between places, emphasis on change. She must be the changes she's seen. She is the movie tone news. Her costumes reflect what has crossed the world stage in her time. The earth muffins and hippies standing up for ideals. The armies marching and fighting in the streets. The wealthy and elegant in their fortress retreats. The magical child who somehow emerges, not by guile or force of arms, but by luck and mystery. And it's always sexy. Because to keep the story going, there must be new actors entering the stage. Babies. And the intrigue and mystery that brings them forth. Welcome to Earth, the traveling circus and epic battle. We are the entertainment planet, with great defeats and triumphs. The universe loves a story. Legal. All hail Ines Schmolansky. Our new project attorney had finalized all the contracts, and our legal status was finally getting cleared up. Mel Torme had certainly squandered a lot of my time. Ines was more than competent. She was momentum. Why movie? Considering the question of why movie, here's what I wrote on November 16th of 2006. If an army tank is rolling down the street, throwing a bottle at it won't do much, but hit the driver over the head with that bottle and the tank becomes neutral. See the man behind the curtain. Mind you, a tank is a formidable weapon and can still do lots of damage, but the tank is not the enemy, and maybe the driver isn't either. It's the ultimate owner of the driver and the tank. The owners hold title because they tell themselves and the world around them a very compelling story. But heavens, it's just a story. And that story isn't a happy one for most. I resolve this day to tell a story that will serve the earth and the people who love earth. A lawn is not a meadow. A garden is not a forest. A swimming pool is not a pond. And here's this from November 19th, 2006. What is effective? To feel. To become acutely aware of sensation. To pay attention to it. To explore its range and depth. To go deeper and feel the universe, every flutter of leaf, the thoughts and feelings of others, the slight torque of a trunk of an oak in the wind. What is happening inside? What am I inside? Muscle, bone, and welling up of emotion. The knowing in all its flavors. Knowing inside. Attentive to within. Even movies are not frivolous. They are the ocean we choose to sail. Emotion. Story. So if we train and open awareness, the principles become innate. They can inform everything we are. Immersion in the water of being. It's not a ground of being. It's the water of being. Three-dimensional waves. The peaks and troughs of information. Nothing. Bubbling. So, to translate. Our apparent circumstance is a story we tell ourselves, whether we are oppressed or free. And feeling is how new stories are possible. It's so easy. You've been listening to the Daughter of Godcast, episode 016, an especially longer one. We're on the cusp of the pithy core of the story. By analogy, we're wrapping up the first movie in the original Star Wars trilogy. The Empire is about to strike back. 2007 through 2011 were not looking so good for your podcaster. More heroes die. The rebel base is a smoking ruin. The search begins for the lost Jedi paradise. Joseph Campbell wondered where the new myths would come from. Little did he know, he would become the new myth.
Ramirez.
Count via electronics, moronic. If running private code, any script kiddie could hack. More vulnerable than Windows. Who wears the black hats? Ruskies or Uskies?